After the presentation, David Grellman will be leading the time for audience questions and participations. And as we begin our time together, Kathy Cadell is going to offer a word of prayer. As you can see, we're passing mics around today.
Let's bow our heads. Our dear Heavenly Father, we thank you so much for this beautiful fall weather that we're enjoying outside. Yeah. We're so thankful that we live in this free country where we can gather to discuss issues that affect us in our Christian life as well as in our life as citizens of this country. We ask that you be with us as we hear more about how humans are changing the world around us and what our responsibilities as Christians are to that world. We pray in your name. Amen.
Our next forum program is actually next week. We've had a kind of a funny schedule working around things this year. But on November 19, a week from today, Rachel Williams Smith, who is chair of the communications department here at Andrews, will present Toward an Understanding of Religious Extremism. And I just remind you that if you aren't getting email notifications and would like to, there's some sign-up sheets in the back where you can give us the information. And we do appreciate the people that are behind the scenes and beside the scenes helping us. Terry Calkins, Debbie Robertson, Kathy Goodell with publicity, Daryl Legault with our audiovisual, and we have not Jim Harris today, but Noelle Harris, his daughter, who is helping us out with the recordings since Jim is out of town. So welcome and thanks, special thanks to you. In recent years, scientists have proposed that we're now living in a new geological epoch, which has been called the Anthropocene. This new epoch being characterized by the changes which human beings and their activities have caused to the Earth and its climate and biological systems. Now, our program today, Dr. Stanton Flavianca, is going to provide us an anthropological perspective on how humans have impacted the natural systems of our planet. We could take the rest of the time talking about Dr. LaBianca's responsibilities and accomplishments and all that, but for some of you who may not know, I will mention he's professor of anthropology here at Andrews, joined the faculty in 1980, has served as chairman of the Behavioral Sciences Department, as graduate programs coordinator for the department. He's also associate director of the Institute of Archaeology here at Andrews. He is co-director of the, Madaba Plains Project in Jordan, and he's senior director of the Jordan Field School at Tal Hizban, also in Jordan. He's a trustee of and member of the board of the American Schools of Oriental Research in Boston and the American Center for Oriental Research in Amman. He helped to develop an archaeological field school in Jordan where there are digs done annually under his guidance. He was instrumental in beginning the Andrews Service Learning Program, as well as the Master's Program in Community and International Development. And as you might guess, he's kind of a citizen of the world. He was born in Norway, studied at Adventist colleges and universities in the Middle East, in France, in the US, and holds a PhD from Brandeis University. So, time is yours. Thank you so much for sharing with us.
Thank you. I want to begin today by inviting you to see a film that has just been released by the National Geographic Society, Before the Flood. This film provides a nice complement to the presentation I will give today. It is a story about how humans are changing the world. And it is called Before the Flood because it describes very well the future that we are looking at given current trends. I am concerned about what kind of world I will leave for my grandchildren. There's a wonderful ancient Native American saying, we do not inherit the earth from our ancestors, we borrow it from our children. I think it's a very sober thought. So the topic of today has great relevance, not just for us, but as we think more broadly about the long term. I also come to this topic from the perspective of a Christian who believes I have a God-given duty to care for the earth. And a favorite text in this respect is Psalm 24. The earth is the Lord's, and all its fullness thereof. The mandate to take care of the earth is also there right from the beginning in the book of Genesis. We were asked to be stewards of the earth. So I think that's important, that it matters how we are treating the earth. Another perspective that is, of course, very important to this story and why this topic has great relevance to me is that my career has been devoted to thinking about how culture changes over the long term. I started out working at a biblical site called Tal Heshbon in Jordan, Biblical Heshbon, and we were primarily focused on the biblical period. But it turns out that the site had 21 layers spanning 3 millennia, and we needed a broader framework for understanding that history, which is what led me to an interest in long-term historical patterns. And so I have been very attuned to any research that deals with the long-term and concepts and constructs for thinking about the long-term. Well, imagine my surprise. Every time I look at this timeline of human population. Because if you look at this timeline, you'll notice that over the last multiple thousands of years, we have had a population of less than 1 billion people. But then suddenly, toward the end of the second millennium AD, there's an arch that goes up, and it climbs very, very rapidly up. When I was born, the population of the Earth was about 3.5 billion. Today, it is approaching 8 billion. So this is totally unprecedented in the history of the world. That's the first thing I think we need to be mindful of, that this is an incredible, incredible change. Furthermore, the reason this population has exploded like this is not because third world people have just gotten super excited about having kids, as some people think. It's because of remarkable advancements in science, starting with the sanitation movement. Then add to that the improvements in mother-infant care, improvements in the treatment of illness and immunization in particular. And then the Green Revolution, which provided food for this remarkable expansion in human population. So there are reasons, strong scientific reasons, why we're still able to feed a population that is totally beyond anything that has been known in the history of humanity. So this is a very remarkable phenomenon, but surely it must also have an impact on the earth or habitat. And that, of course, is the topic of today. Now, in the late 1990s, a group of scientists began to work together to try to document the trends in changes in the Earth and also in human populations that are happening, that have been starting to happen. And an iconic study in this regard is this group from the University of Stockholm that began working on what they called the great acceleration charts. What are these great acceleration charts? Well, this is what it looks like. This is an international effort to look at trends in human socioeconomic realm as well as in Earth systems that are affecting and impacting the Earth, especially since the year 1750. So if you first take a look at the left side of the panel, the socioeconomic trends, there again is that rapid expansion in human population, but with that has come a great expansion also in gross domestic products around the world, in foreign direct investment, in urban populations, enormous change in that direction, primary energy use, fertilizer consumption, large dams, water use, paper production, transportation, telecommunication, international tourism. Every one of these charts indicate this rapid change, something unprecedented in human history. And as these changes in human trends have occurred, the Earth has also had been impacted. And so we see on the right panel, changes in carbon dioxide levels, changes in nitrogen oxide, in methane, stratospheric ozone, surface temperatures, ocean acidification, marine fish capture, shrimp aquaculture, nitrogen coastal zones, tropical forest loss, domesticated land, terrestrial biosphere degradation. So this is an ongoing study keeping track of these trends. The chart has become iconic of any discussion of this new era called the Anthropocene. So the world that I was born into is not the same today as when I was born. And that can be said for, I think, all of us out here, especially as we are older. I, in fact, came from a little village in southern Norway where we still used horse and buggy to harvest the hay. And there were cars, but airplanes were just beginning to fly, and at least the commercial air traffic. I remember also that the television was totally new. I think I saw the first television when I was like six or seven. Cars, we were one of the early adopters of a car. And I mean, these things happened earlier in the United States. But in Norway, where I grew up, that was my childhood. So that was the Earth back then. Imagine the Earth in which my grandchildren are growing up. What an incredible change that has occurred. Notice the hockey stick appearance of these changes, these trends. The scientist that is credited with naming this new era is Paul Crutzen, a chemist who made his life work to document the changes in the Earth ozone layers, for which he received a Nobel laureate in 1995. So the Anthropocene is this new era that comes at the end of the geological column. The previous, the era that we have typically thought that we are living in is the Holocene, which is the era of human culture. But now something is happening so remarkably different that the consensus, in fact, is that we have to name this new era something else. We are exiting the Holocene, the era of human slow change culture, and giving it a new name. A new name signals it's the fact that today humans are indirectly beginning to change Earth systems. Before this Anthropocene, the human impact was much less there, though it is there, but not to the degree of today. Today, the extent to which we are impacting the human Earth systems is so overwhelming that, in fact, it can be documented on many levels. For example, in organic matter is here showing up in a West Greenland glacier core. This effectively demarcates the onset of the Anthropocene in these cores from Iceland. There is evidence of cumulative growth of manufactured aluminum and SPCs and black carbon in the Earth's surface. And so these are again documented by the group that I referred to earlier. There's also this sad cumulative pattern of extinction in vertebrate species, including mammals, birds, fish, and all types of vertebrates are losing their habitats and becoming extinct. So these are processes that are well documented under this new era of human impact on the environment. This is precisely what the Anthropocene is about. The fact that the Earth is now, in a sense, in human hands. And why is this? It is because, in part, our outsized dependence on oil and other fossil fuels for transportation, heating, cooling, and a myriad of other services, surely unprecedented in all of human history. And I love big ships. And this one is just one of the many evidences of this kind of this dependence we have, which is so outsized compared to anything else. Sorry. Now, another reason for this Anthropocene, the human impact on the environment, is, of course, our American diet, which, of course, is spreading around the world. And that diet is here graphically illustrated in a kind of a neat chart. It shows the greenhouse gas impact of different types of diets per person and per year, represented in car kilometers. And so, for example, if you eat a largely vegan diet, your annual income impact is only 281 kilometers. If you are a lacto-ovo-vegetarian, you are impacting at the level of 1,975 kilometers. And if you eat meat and dairy, you're impacting at 4,377 kilometers per year. So that really shows how just our diet makes an impact. And of course, as most of you know, one of the big contributors to this is our demand for beef and other large animal meats, which take up so much of the Earth's resources to produce. And this study of the Anthropocene, which I reported on earlier, namely coming from the American Association of Science, is here reported in a public manner. And the title is, "You Cause 600 Square Feet of Arctic Ice to Melt Each Year." That's the estimate based on these studies by the Stockholm University group, that each of us are impacting by our diet, by our patterns of transportation, by our lifestyle. And that, you can imagine, accounts for why it is that that ice melts, that water has to go somewhere. And so we have rising sea levels. And if you talk to the mayor of Miami, for him, this is no hoax. This is a very real thing that he's planning for having to deal with, and many other cities are being impacted. So what is being done about this challenge? Well, there's the International Working Group on Climate Change. They have, for the past two decades, been warning governments, business leaders, and the public that we are fast running out of options for dealing with the consequences of the Great Acceleration. They've been calling and urging governments to take the lead in weaning us off of our dependence on fossil fuels and showing the way to alternative sources of energy. And I must say I'm an admirer of Elon Musk. Just this month, there have been stories about him having kind of pulled together a unified program of use of solar that includes new solar tiles that don't look ugly, but that look like standard tiles. They collect the sun, energy from the sun, and then those are stored in a battery wall, which then will provide energy for the house, for the car, and he's building a gigafactory for producing these batteries. I mean, this is a vision of how one might, in fact, how we can expect the future to emerge, thanks to a very visionary entrepreneur trying to address the problem. Also, the insurance industry cannot ignore the reality of the Anthropocene, because they keep careful track of incidents of natural disasters, as is shown here, and their actuaries are having to incorporate into their planning the likelihood of disasters, and they are increasing over time. This graph shows the increase in disasters between 1980 and 2010. Both these are geophysical events, and they are, I can hardly read it here.
Meteorological
events, and geological and climatological events. And so the actuarial sciences are taking into account the fact that things are changing in our environment. It also has impact for real estate in the coastal areas. Rising sea levels could swallow Florida's tax base, which is based on the fact that people come to enjoy the beaches and all of the real estate along the beaches. Even here in Michigan, its Department of Natural Resources has been mindful of the fact that the climate change is changing the outlook for the Great Lakes in terms of both levels, but also in terms of the cleanliness of these lakes and the availability of the water for the use that we need for as humans. Now, you can also take a light look at this and simply laugh at these people because they are, obsessed. And so here we have the positive proof of global warming is the shrinking size of female underwear. And that's all that it needs to be something to laugh about, but I dare say it's more than that. But a more serious fact is that our leaders, the elites in our country, are over 50% of them are deniers of this phenomenon. These charts show that the 113th Congress, of its members, 127 are deniers. Of state governors, over half are deniers, that there's nothing, that we're not having an impact. And these leaders control over 63% of the population. What they say matters. People listen to their leaders. And of course, as talk radio, and I do listen to Rush Limbaugh quite faithfully because I want to understand the perspective of the deniers. What is really troubling to me is that as we were looking earlier at that tremendous rise in human population, and how though that population exploded, we were able to largely provide food and increase the longevity of people because we were taking science seriously, and there was a certain level of trust between scientists and governors. What is happening today, and this is a real crisis, can we deal with the Anthropocene if half of our leaders don't trust the scientific community and they deny the findings of rigorous peer-reviewed science? That is a real issue that we have to think about as we go forward in trying to address the problem we're dealing with. And one of the big challenges as a culture that come up in this context is the tyranny of short-term thinking vis-a-vis long-term thinking. Now, by short-term thinking, I mean, for example, not going to the gym today, buying new clothes, not calling your parents or friends, drinking instead of studying, not going to work today. Whereas long-term thinking might be consistently working out and seeing weight loss, putting a down payment on a house and paying it off, having a close relationship with family and friends, graduating with honors, and having a career that you love. To do the latter, you have to sacrifice certain things to achieve these greater goods for the long term. Well, this tyranny of short-term thinking is actually built into our culture, especially with what is called shareholder capitalism. This is the version of capitalism that emphasizes the importance of earning profits now, and that straitjacket is there because of quarterly reports where the shareholders are looking to each of their corporations to make sure that they're going to gain in profit. And so this tyranny of having to produce a profit means sacrificing long-term for the short-term. We are in a straitjacket of having to produce profit in the short-term and unable, it seems, to engage the long-term. The inconvenient truth, however, for shareholder capitalism, that should be shareholder capitalism, is the truth about externalities. There are many externalities that the economic model of shareholder capitalism does not take into account. The effect of production in our factories, such as air pollution from factories, pollution from fertilizer, industrial waste, noise pollution, collapsing fish stocks, methane emissions, these are all externalities that the traditional economic model doesn't really quite manage to take into account. Also, there are negative consumption externalities, such as vehicle pollution, household wastes, noise pollution from neighbors, air pollution from smokers, traffic congestion, gambling addiction, litter from tourists, spillover costs from obesity, and all these externalities that I'm not reckoned with by Coca-Cola when they're selling Coca-Cola, because their main goal is to make profit for their shareholders. You can even therefore say that the modern food system is not about providing food, it's about providing profit for the corporations. And that's why the closer you come to the checkout counter, the less healthy the food is for you. It's going to be all these things that are there strictly for profit, has nothing to do with your nutrition. We are kind of in a straitjacket of short-term thinking. Now, if this is to be the model for human development around the world, what are the consequences? Well, this graphic shows you what it would be like if everybody were to attain the kind of lifestyle of consumption that we have. We would need 4.1 Earths to provide that level of resources. And if you were to live at least on the level of the French, you would still need 2.5 Earths. Or at the level of people in Costa Rica, you would need 1.4 Earths. So the point is the question is, can we all, humanity, live like Americans? Not so, and still survive with the limited resources we have. So there are two possible visions of human development then. One vision is that of the straitjacket of the gross national product, that we have to grow it every year, which means that we need to have consumers who will buy and buy and buy. Or there's the idea of the gross national happiness, which is actually the goal, the formal measure adopted by the nation of Bhutan. They have rejected the GNP model for their country, but rather have embraced and developed the idea of a gross national happiness scale. They are more concerned about their members having access to such things as good work, time balance, arts and culture, education, the environment, governance, health, community, and so forth. Actually, this is the goal for a different version of the future. Interestingly, too, this is a study that I don't have all the details of how they arrived at these measures. It's in the article that I'm citing here from a general survey produced by the World Bank. But what it shows is that between 1972 and 2012, while consumption levels increased significantly, in fact greatly, per capita, levels of happiness and levels of life satisfaction did not change. So the idea that we have to be on the treadmill of growth in order to be happy is actually not supported by data from research. We are kind of instead being enticed into this particular lifestyle. So an alternative model of capitalism is stakeholder capitalism. The idea is here that more than simply providing profit for the shareholders, we now take into account all the stakeholders that are affected by the business that we are in. One corporation that has actually tried to move in this direction is the Whole Foods Corporation. So this is actually their model for the economy. They are concerned with team members' happiness, the partners and their vendors and their relationship with them, that they have satisfied customers, that they have motivated donors, and that they have community and environmental responsiveness. So they're trying to reckon much more broadly with the stakeholders that are part of and impacted by the society. And here's this Greek proverb. As society grows great, when old men plant trees whose shade they know they shall never sit in. This is long-term thinking. And it is not beyond capitalism to adopt long-term thinking. But we have the challenge of trying to understand how to move beyond, and of taking seriously the science that is pointing in the direction of the Anthropocene. One of the efforts to try to broaden the way in which we think about the environment is to think of the Earth as a provider of ecosystem services. And this has come under some criticism, because do we really want to take the calculus of economics and now apply it to nature? But it may be necessary as an intermediary step toward moving away from a strictly economic view of the economy toward a much more balanced, holistic view. And so in this kind of a vision, the idea is to actually assign value to clean air, monetary value to clean good soil, to wilderness and land, to good water, so that when we figure the full cost of our business, we incorporate those factors into the calculus of the economy, and that in turn will give us strong economy, well-being, food, water, and search, and public health. So the idea of the world providing us with ecosystem services. There's even now a calculator that's being developed that you can go to a store and look at a car, and then you can look at it and it'll tell you the actual impacts of producing that car on air, soil, land, and water, along with the workers and the whole bit. So you actually get the full calculus, so you can have ecological intelligence as you do your shopping. Very interesting new development. So, toward an ethics for the Anthropocene, such an ethic has to start with our God-given duty to care. It involves a more mindful approach to consumption. It involves seeing that we are all together in this. The problems of the Anthropocene cannot be solved at the national level. They are problems that require us as a globe to get together, people from all over the world, and cooperating in this effort. And it provides, while individualism is a good thing, it needs to be less egocentrical, so that as we are being individual, creative entrepreneurs, we are also mindful of others and the consequences of our actions. I mentioned earlier the problem of denial, and much of that denial even coming at high levels of government. The truth is that we don't need to wait for governments. Bottom up trumps top down. In other words, we can take action by being more mindful consumers, by realizing that we need to be together as a whole people of the earth, and being less egocentric in our individualism. Now I want to come back to who we are. We are a community of Seventh-day Adventists. Many of us come from that tradition. And our pioneers, for them, what they cared about was to get the good news of the soon coming of the Messiah to the world. That was their sense of duty to care. These same pioneers also had this notion that the health message is the right arm of the gospel. And so the question is, can we today perhaps lift up the right arm of the gospel? Because that really is extremely relevant to today. And today, indeed, that is happening. There are timely visions of our duty to care, exemplified by the New Start program. You know what New START stands for: nutrition, exercise, water, sunshine, temperance, air, rest, trust in God. These are Adventist ideas about taking care of the body that require a approach that also incorporates the environment. And then Florida Hospital, they have what they call creation health. And that also includes nutrition, one's outlook, interpersonal relationships, trust, activity, environment is directly part of their vision, rest and choice. We as Seventh-day Adventists actually have a wonderful foundation on which to build and engage, as Pastor Dwight talked about this morning. From the bottom up, this challenge that we face as humanity. And here at Andrews University as well, we are in a unique position to forward this vision of health and care of the earth. Look at the many affiliated institutions around the world where this university takes its curricula and teaches its teachers as well as students, and we have an opportunity to share a vision about the future that is a sustainable vision based on a responsible approach. I also, of course, am especially excited about our Master in Arts International Development, where we take our training to the very countries where people live. And this is the program that probably raises more of the world's poor than any other master's program we have. It's a program that is directly allowing people locally to adopt and to bring to the training their culture, even as we can bring to them this awareness of the earth and its care. And so in conclusion, this is an appeal from a little child. Save our planet. Don't be mean. Go green. And remember, bottom up trumps top down. Thank you very much.
Dr. LaBianca will now take questions. If you raise your hand, I'll bring the mic to you.
Thank you very much. Very timely. And in keeping with that timeliness, what are the implications for our very recent history? And I'm not thinking only of the United States and our recent elections, but what appears to be a turn, a hard right turn, both in Europe, Central Europe, yeah, as well as North America, for the future of the Anthropocene?
Great question. You know, I've shown the chart of the great acceleration, and I've shown how in my own life and your lives things are changing very, very rapidly, and I think one of the reasons for this crawling back into our own comfort zone, which is occurring in Europe here and elsewhere, is people are afraid of these changes and are being overwhelmed by them. Another reason is that elites, and this is why all these things that are going on are actually a confrontation with the masses and the elites. Elites are the ones that are actually greatly gaining from these connections, and they're leaving out the masses, and there's a pushback. And that's not to say that there are other things going on, but this is actually the history of long-term, of the collapse of empires. Typically, empires in the history of the world collapse when there are too many elites, and those elites start fighting among themselves for resources, not minding the lives of the masses, and we are seeing it repeating itself again. And one could be quite fearful of the future, because if history is a lesson, we go through these episodes or periods when we really collapse, and we fight, and we have wars, and we've had two big ones in the previous century, and then we kind of come back to our senses, and they go on. But every one of those big wars are largely due to elites that are fighting over resources. And this is really happening today, and it explains to me, at least, what's happening with this election. The Trump being elected was largely on the, as they vote against globalization and this sense of disenfranchisement from the opportunities that the elites are enjoying. That would be my take on it anyway. Any other questions or comments? I mean, maybe you're not you want to speak up against what I've said. Yes.
What are the predictions for Miami? What are the predictions for Miami?
Oh, I would first say, Before the Flood film is available. You can just Google it and see it on your computer. It's not on Netflix or anything, it's just available. Just look for Before the Flood. And there they interview the mayor of Miami, and they are putting big bucks into building, infrastructure to protect the city from a rising ocean. And of course, they have already seen parts of their city being flooded many times already. So Miami is definitely at risk, and many other cities several other cities in the U.S. and also around the world. The global warming and the rise of the oceans is, as I just indicated, I mean, the evidence is overwhelming on that score. Yes, Ken.
I don't want to use the word breastfeeding here to describe what you've been presented. The question that came into my mind is, you're the authority, you're the one that understands this stuff, and the rest of it is that, for myself, I don't think of one thing in this room that I would, and one thing that I would do, or that I'm aware of that I need to do. Yeah, sure, I've got bags, yellow bags that I put up for recycling stuff. And, you know, every little thing matters. But really, I mean, this is one of the things that I think is interesting intellectually, but I can't imagine what I could do to solve this problem. And we could go ahead and study the problem, but what do they call it, paralysis of analysis?
Yeah.
I'm not sure just what
well, I
some of us here in this room should do about it, except
I
worry about it, and
things.
I don't choose to do that.
Yeah, I mentioned three or four things. I think that mindful consumerism is very important, that we actually make choices that impact how we use resources.
As in, don't eat meat or milk?
To start with.
Okay.
And beyond that, in how we, you know, one of the most polluting industries of all is the clothing industry.
Clothing.
It's enormous.
We should
polluting.
Go back to Eden.
Well, that's true. But the point, and so in addition to that, I also think that what we can do individually is also to be much more, to share the information and to create awareness. And again, so I think we have to begin with acknowledging that there's a problem, and then we go forward from there. Was there another comment? Yeah.
I know growing up, things that other Christians would say as a fight back towards a global warming, for example, or reasons why we should not be afraid of floods,
yeah,
is God's promise that he won't flood the universe. But it still didn't, I mean, even me too at the time, it didn't make sense as to why that would be a reason why we shouldn't care about the environment. But I'm just wondering how, is that kind of changing, or are there, like, I guess tactically, are they starting to avoid the warnings of floods, or how would you respond to it as a Christian?
Well, I'm not quite sure. Are you talking about our particular Adventist teachings about the end and prophecy, or I'm not quite sure what your question is.
Oh, sorry, as to how to go about convincing Christians that flood aside, we should still care about the environment.
Okay, well, that, yeah. I want to come back to our own community of faith. I'm very, very glad to be part of Andrews University and of the Adventist Global Project, because I believe that what we are doing in teaching about vegetarianism is as important as what Elon Musk is doing with his cars and his battery banks and his solar cells. In terms of impact, if people were to learn to live like many of you and I, many of us here do, that would be incredibly important for saving the earth and being mindful stewards. I have friends who have not lived in our community and in our culture. For them, it's not easy to make the kinds of changes we have. For us, it's natural. And so we actually have an opportunity here to really engage in a very significant way with this problem. Most policymakers can't imagine a world where people eat less, but actually it's one of the most important things we can do. It's as important as cutting back on many other things. So we're already doing something, and we have some very specific knowledge. So that comes back to your question. I think we just need to lift up our tradition of healthful living, the New Start ideas and the creation health. These, to me, this is the future for Adventism. That's preparing for the future. That's carrying forward the vision of the pioneers. I don't know if I answered your question, but give me a chance to get excited about being a part of this movement.
I think it does matter. I think by being active in putting a positive light on our tradition and seeing how it is relevant in these ways. And I want to say that again. I believe that our tradition of vegetarian and living close down low on the food chain is as important as what is happening at the Tesla, which is an enormous thing that's being done. But well, you saw the chart I had in terms of kilometers. If you eat vegan, it's like a sixth of the impact of when you eat constantly red meat. Yeah.
You know, obviously you are passionate about it, and I think it's important to be passionate. But we also need to remember that, and let me say this, that as a person who believes climate change is happening, and that it's caused by humankind, but I'm somewhat skeptical that we can do too much about it realistically. And I say that in the sense that it's easy to say Americans should cut their consumption, but as the world population grows, it's inevitable that we are going to continue to put more carbon in the atmosphere. We can slow the rate of increase, but increase it will.
You know,
and the other thing I wanted to just jump in, I think it's important to be really carefully accurate on these things too, and recognize that when we show the huge rise in population, perhaps you should also show the graphs that show that the rate of population increase is slowing down considerably.
It is.
And that there is a stasis predicted.
Absolutely.
So it isn't going to continue.
No, absolutely. It's a candle hop. It's going to go down.
And similarly, the graphs showing the Great Lakes shrinking are out of date because, in fact, they're now above in the last 2 years. Their average, I attended a conference in Toronto in 2008 where somebody was saying if the rate of shrinkage of the Great Lakes continues, they will cease to exist within 200 years. You know, it was one of these, if the rate continues. But the fact is, these cycles, I think, we just need to be careful about overgeneralizing.
Yeah. Well, thank you. I think that's good. If you go to the Michigan Natural Resources website, they do have a section dealing with global warming. So they're addressing it as having an impact, but it may be of other nature than just simply a change in the lake levels. But I do fully agree that this is not a continuous trend that is declining in the population. It will definitely taper off. And as to the question of what can we do, you remember, was it a little bit over a year ago, we had a tremendous Ebola outbreak in Africa, and the predictions were we were going to have 1.5 million people that were going to suddenly be dying from Ebola. Well, it turns out that only 30,000 died. And the reason is because we were that is to say, the United States organized an infrastructure. They were able to address the problem by good scientific intervention. And that's what I was getting at earlier, to deny this attitude of skepticism toward good science and is one of our biggest challenges. If we embrace this, as clearly is happening among entrepreneurs like Elon Musk, they have taken this seriously. That's not a hoax for him. And he's actually showing that you can have an economy that comes from it. But it's as we as a grassroots people begin to speak to our representatives, that this matters, that it trickles up. That's what I meant by when I said bottom up trumps top down. Because I really think that it has to start with this kind of an awareness, and then eventually the policies will be made. And you also go to Europe, boy, they have made a lot more, they are taking global warming very seriously. And you see that and also the whole aspect of taking care of the environment. We were just talking, Jim and I, about the Norwegian policy of friluftsliv, where they are totally devoted to making the land a resource for the population. So again, it comes back to the people themselves and what they want. And while I was shocked by the latest developments, I actually think that I'm hoping that, in fact, there will be time for opportunity to impact this administration as well. In fact, that follow in the news, there are many things that are indicating that there will be possibilities for positivism there too. Yeah.
Stan, I have a hard time figuring out what all these ideas, whether they're positive to the environment or negative to the environment. You take ethanol, that was supposed to save us from pollution.
Yeah.
But some things I've read, ethanol and its manufacturer is more polluting than if we just used oil. And I read the same thing where wind power now is being talked about. It has to be subsidized by huge subsidies to make it cost effective.
Thank you. This is so important, and that's why there's a whole new discipline coming on. It's called ecological intelligence. And it's about looking at the costs from the very production of these technologies through to their use. We are not, when you go and buy a new technology today, we really don't know what we are buying. But with the availability of little calculators that you can use on your computer, you can go in, and this is actually, there's a book now, it's called Ecological Intelligence. And there's a group developing an app where you go to a store and you can look up what is the full cost of this product. And as we become more mindful consumers, we will then in turn be able to make choices that hopefully are in favor of the environment rather than making mistakes. So you're absolutely right. We don't really know the full impact. And I mean, just making of batteries, I'm sure that that's not without considerable effect on the environment as well. But the point is that we have, I think there's plenty of evidence that if we engage intelligently with these issues, and God gave us intelligence, and with an attitude of care, we can make progress. It's as we stick our head in the sand and deny and call it all a hoax that we're going to have a real problem. Yeah.
Stan, I want to thank you for a great presentation. And I resonate with what you said. I'd like to follow up on what John said. I agree that we probably can't stop climate change. We can't stop a lot of these things, but we can slow them down. And I'd like to also say that, you know, when I first started teaching, we were in the global or the nuclear winter situation. Reagan was president, so on, there was so much. And I was very depressed about that. I used to talk about that with my students. And I found out it just discourages students, you know, to talk about that. But what I began to realize, and what I began to teach, was that we can make a difference. We are seeing differences. When I was in 1970, I worked in a camp Southern California. I can't think of the name of it now. Anyway, I used to come down from the San Jacinto Mountains into the Riverside area. There was this pall over Los Angeles. You could not see. It was a blanket of brown smog. You go out there today and it's cleaner.
Oh yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
So why is that? Well, it's because people decided to make a difference and the government stepped in to do something.
Exactly.
Governments have a role in helping us control our consumption.
Exactly. No, I fully agree. It matters that we start with a vision from below. We engage honestly the data rather than thinking of it as a hoax. By the way, I do really try to read on both sides of the issue, and I would recommend two books. This is The End of Doom by Ronald Bailey, which is all about countering the negativism and the dark view. And this one is remarkable. It's called Progress, The 10 Reasons to Look Forward to the Future. This book engages these problems, but it's also very optimistic about an honest engagement with science and with data, because then people can make a difference. But what troubles me is an attitude of askance, the word, our own ability to be rational about these problems, and thus neglecting our duty to care, God-given duty to care. Yes.
Stan, I appreciate what you said today. I have a couple of questions that maybe you can help me with. First of all, in a hunting-gathering society, you look at very small groups.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, number one, if looking at the larger scene as you have done today, that we would maybe merge the I, we, because we're realizing that in taking care of you and others around me, I am taking very good care of myself. And number two, you mentioned what it would take among resources to live like we live in the United States. Mm-hmm. If we took that in terms of indebtedness, I wonder what the figure would look like. I'm wondering if it wouldn't just blow the whole place up.
If by that you mean the fact that our consumption is greatly impacting the quality of life of people around the world, that's what I meant by the graph showing we're all in this together. Because in fact, this is not a problem you can solve within the American border. We have to start at home, but we also have to work collaboratively around the world in global vision. And also, I just want to come back to this too, that I think perhaps of all the things I've said in terms of dealing with this, one of the biggest challenges we have as a nation is our current vision of capitalism. And I distinguish between a shareholder-oriented capitalism that's primarily concerned with making profit for a few, and stakeholder capitalism, which is about making a world that works for everybody. It's still capitalism, but it is an embracing capitalism. And that is where we, you know, can we move in that direction? Now, this is a big discussion within economic circles, because if you know anthropologists, we've long criticized the strict economic model for being too concerned just with material consumption. And you mentioned hunter-gatherers. Their life was not primarily about growth. In Australia, for thousands of years, they've lived without any growth, but they've lived comfortable lives. They're the original affluent society. They only worked 4 hours a day to maintain themselves. But their happiness was not built on consumption. We are quite unique in history in the extent to which we've come to be reliant upon stuff, entangled in things. It's not going to happen overnight, but it has to begin with an open discussion about who we are. And when I teach anthropology, I spend as much time talking about who we are as about the rest of the world, because we need to understand ourselves. Yes?
I want to come back to my first question, just at least to some degree. And I hope I'm not introducing an awkward aspect into this, but I mentioned this turn to the hard right that appears to be taking place. The church generally reflects society, and our church also seems to be
turning that way,
making a hard turn to the right. What are the implications of this for our universities and most of us in a gathering like this?
Right here. It's us that's turning to the right. It's not them. We need to die off. That's the answer. Or get rid of it. It's true. It's not them. It's us.
We'll take one or two more questions.
It seems to me that addressing these problems raises some sort of global justice questions. You pointed out how it would take 4.2 Earths or something to sustain our
level of consumption.
Obviously, if we just decide to maintain the status quo, you know, that we're not going to pollute anymore, nobody's going to increase their consumption, that still wouldn't solve the problem. And certainly, Western affluent societies are not willing to cut their levels of pollution by 75%, let's say. And you have the areas of the world that are contributing relatively little to pollution because they have a relatively low standard of living. And they're saying, well, hey, you guys have already done it. Now you've got the advantages. We want to be like you. And it's sort of hard to tell them, well, no, you've got to stay in your underdeveloped poverty, low level of resources, I mean, of consumer resources,
So how do you bring the justice into that?
You know, in on the African continent, they bypass the whole phase of communications development. They never put in the infrastructure of wires for telephone. They went directly to the cell phone. And why do they have to repeat the mistakes that we have had, you know, in developing? And Bhutan has completely rejected the gross national product measure used by economists to measure progress, and instead developed their own gross national happiness measure. And that is what they use to see whether they are making a difference for their people. So, you know, while I think, yes, there is this sense of that the West owes us something, or we now should be able to pollute, but I think in the end that we all have a stake in embracing the fact that we have all, that there's one globe. We have all had a stake in solving this problem together. I know that's very idealistic talk, but in my own research, I'm actually in Jordan trying to develop a view of the history of Jordan that is not denominational, or imperial, or national, but a history of a place that's global, as in, because we need a new history of Europe. People tend to think in terms of particular histories, their Western and so forth. We are faced with a new world, a global world.
I just wanted to comment on what you said about the university students. In the last several years of teaching, last 3, 4, 5 years of teaching, when I ask students what they want to do with their lives, I'm shocked. For example, right now I have mostly School of Business students, and it's all things like, I want to start an orphanage. I want to find out God's will for my life so I can start a business that helps humankind. I want to start an NGO to help people who are disadvantaged in such and such place. I want to do this for people. I want to do that for people. I want to follow Jesus. In 30 years of teaching, I have never seen such consistently high values as the millennial, so-called millennial generation has. I find that very exciting and hopeful. And when I think about, I don't really care for Christmas because in this country it's an orgy of materialism that makes me feel sick. But Jesus Christ, the one that we celebrate, the gift, he gave himself to other people. He gave himself. And as I think about what it really means to be a Christian and to give ourselves to others and to care for the earth and to care for God's responsibilities that God has given us, it's such a great time to be a Christian because the way of Jesus is in such sharp relief and contrast right now that it really means something. And our students know that, and I'm really, really proud of them.
Absolutely, I agree wholeheartedly. This is my experience as well. It's a joy to be part of our education for that reason.
It is.
Thank you for your talk. Some of the discussion here, a lot of what you've mentioned, revolve quite a bit around ecology on one side, and also on the haves versus the have-nots and masses. Are those two related somehow? Does solving one solve the other? Or, you know, how are they related? Or are they unrelated? Are they two things that we need to work on, both of them? Or
you mean the haves and the have-nots?
What? Most ecology. Does working on ecology and saving our resources affect the other one?
You know, there's something called the Washington Consensus. And that is the idea that for the rest of the world to have what we have, then they need to adopt neoliberalism, which is basically our model of economy with a lot of free markets, open trade, and all those things that go with free markets. That has happened in India. We have had a tremendous change. India's gone from being a very poor country to, while there's still poverty, the levels of poverty have drastically reduced thanks to that model. Likewise, China was very reduced, very great problems with hunger it's been changed as the neoliberal kind of market open approach has adopted. But we who have sort of perfected this model need to realize its limitation. And the limitation is that it creates a wall between markets and business and the environment. So ecology is on the outside, that's the externals. And it, and then the, we just work within that little model. And that's what I'm arguing. Yes, neoliberalism can make a difference, has made a difference, enormous difference, but it has its limits. And we who have been sort of in the driver's seat of it, we are now becoming aware of its limits, and we need to become, help others become aware of it. So yes, there's a connection between how the rest of the world lives and how we live, and I think that the solution is not to just sort of continue to reproduce neoliberalism as we have known it. We need a new vision of it, which is what I'm talking about, the stakeholder capitalism that actually takes into account the externalities in a real way. And we should be showing the way here, rather than resisting it. Yes, John, did you have a comment?
Well, I just wanted to make the comment that, you know, I think when you talked
about the tyranny of the immediate, I think that immediacy is one of the most powerful variables in all of psychology or human nature. It works with when you're training animals or your children or yourself. I mean, immediacy is really important. And I think we just need to be careful and realize that I think that's an issue across the entire political spectrum. It's not just a certain kind of capitalism. The more liberal, entitlement systems also breed a kind of immediate reward versus the long-term thing. And I think until, and of course, during political campaigns, they like to make things very black and white and so forth. But I think how you address that, the preference for immediacy. Like, I can see you going with your calculator and all of the calculations as to how much this shirt is going to cost, but the average person, you know, is going to go into Walmart and see, I can buy this shirt for $4. And I find it hard to believe that they're going to have the discipline to use the meter and that sort of thing. So I just think that...
Actually, there's about a fifth of the U.S. population that has that kind of mentality. That actually are very conscious consumers. And obviously that's not everybody. That's just a small, that's about a fifth. And then you have everything else in between. So, but I think your point is well taken. It's hard, it's maybe Pollyanna to think that everybody is going to become responsible. But by the same token, I wondered when it comes coming right back to our current politics, the idea of Obamacare was that there would be some redistribution of health and some management from the government. If we put it all back to savings accounts, how many people are actually, when they're barely making $7 an hour, are going to be able to save for their health care? You know, and are they going to have the discipline to do it under those conditions? I mean, I think that's an incredibly wild gamble. In the meantime, having millions of people sick sickens the whole society because they become risk for the rest. And it will end up with the hospitals picking it up as indigents, which is exactly how we've done it. We've covered them, but it's from our insurance who can afford it. So, you know, anyway, it'll be interesting to see how that problem is solved.
Last question.
Yeah, last question.
Again, just sorry to have one last comment. On the Bhutan gross national happiness, I know it sounds so wonderful. I've got to offer a couple corrections. It was the previous king who was, by the way, an absolute ruler, and it was one way of telling the Bhutanese citizens that they're happy and they should stay happy. Keep in mind that much as I love the idea of Bhutan too, but their treatment of a couple hundred thousand Nepali refugees who they expelled has been widely condemned by the United Nations. Even Norway has accepted refugees from Bhutan, and so has the United States. They don't have freedom of religion, exactly. And in fact, in the last few years, they've begun to drop this idea of
the happiness
that gross national happiness phrase and speak about development there for improving life of the average Bhutanese, because they were all pretty much at a subsistence level. So it sounds so idealistic, but I would offer a note of caution about using that as your mantra.
I also respect that, because you've been to Bhutan?
No,
but
very
you've
close.
Been to Nepal.
I wanted to go to Nepal, yeah.
Yeah, right. And so I'm aware that it was a kind of an idealistic thing. But it's actually it is part of, I think, what we need to consider. Because also in Denmark, you know, they have, we need to think about other models of growth than the model that says that growth has to be material growth. And these are examples of such models. And they are trials. Isn't that how we discover what works? By finding out benchmarking best practices.
I agree about Denmark. I just don't think Bhutan is a very good example, even though it sounds nice.
Fair enough. I may want to use Denmark next time.
The Rush Limbaughs of the world will knock the legs from us.
Well, that's good. I need to strengthen my argumentation with Rush. Well, thank you very much, everyone. Appreciate it.